Genesis chapter 20 reads as follows. This follows on from the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And we pick it up in verse 1. From there, Abraham journeyed toward the territory of the Negev and lived between Kadesh and Shur and sojourned in Gerar. And Abraham said of Sarah his wife, "She is my sister." And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. But God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, "Behold, you are a dead man because of the woman you have taken, for she is a man's wife." Now Abimelech had not approached her. So he said, "Lord, will you kill an innocent people? Did he not himself say to me, 'She is my sister,' and she herself said, 'He is my brother'? In the integrity of my heart and the innocence of my hands, I have done this." Then God said to him in a dream, "Yes, I know that you have done this in the integrity of your heart, and it was I who kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Now then, return the man's wife, for he is a prophet, so that he will pray for you, and you shall live. But if you do not return her, know that you shall surely die, you and all who are yours." So Abimelech rose early in the morning and called his servants and told them all these things. And the men were much afraid. Then Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, "What have you done to us? And how have I sinned against you that you have brought on me and my kingdom a great sin? You have done to me things that ought not to be done." And Abimelech said to Abraham, "What did you see that you did this thing? And Abraham said, "I did it because I thought, 'There is no fear of God in all this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. Besides, she is indeed my sister, the daughter of my father, though not the daughter of my mother. And she became my wife. And when God caused me to wander from my father's house, I said to her, 'This is the kindness you must do to me. At every place to which we come, say of me, "He is my brother."'" Then Abimelech took sheep and oxen and male servants and female servants and gave them to Abraham and returned Sarah his wife to him. And Abimelech said, "Behold, my land is before you. Dwell where it pleases you." To Sarah he said, "Behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. It is a sign of your innocence in the eyes of all who are with you, and before everyone, you are vindicated." Then Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech, and also healed his wife, and female slaves, so that they bore children. For the Lord had closed all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. This is the word of the Lord. I mentioned before we read this passage that characters come with loaded expectations. We assume some people will behave one way, and we assume others will behave another. We take Abraham, for example. If we know anything about Abraham and the Bible, it's not difficult to put to words the kinds of things we expect from this man. We know that he was called by God. He's given divine promises. He rescued people from invading armies. And he prayed for a wicked city that God would be gracious towards them. And this is the highlights reel of his life, the snapshots, the things that he would put on Facebook, right? The best moments of his life. And on top of that, God crowns him with the title and role of prophet. Take a look at verse 7, where God says, "Abraham is a prophet. He will pray for you and you shall live." All I'm getting at is this. Abraham's life and calling gives us loaded expectations that he will be one of the good guys, right? That he will be someone who will operate his life with integrity. And on the other hand, you have this guy called Abimelech. He was the king of a pagan region where people did not believe in God. As such, there was very little to suggest that he would ever be one of the good guys. In fact, given the reputation of Sodom, which we talked about last week, there was a working assumption in that region. And the working assumption is this, that people who belonged to a pagan area were evil and wicked, and that is all they could ever be. Abraham himself made this assumption, right? That pagan people are this way. They are evil, they are wicked, and that's all they could ever be. Verse 11 tells us about Abraham. He said, I thought the fear of God, there is no fear of God in all this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. In other words, Abraham operated under the assumption that pagans, unbelievers, were incapable of moral virtue. Note that down. That Abraham the believer worked on the assumption that unbelievers would never express any moral virtue. So let's just get that in our minds before we go any further. The two main characters presented to us in this passage is one is a prophet of God and the other is a pagan king. And we expect Abraham, the prophet, to be the moral hero in the story, and we expect Abimelech, the pagan ruler, to be the immoral villain. And yet, what do we find happens in this episode? What happens in this episode? The person we most expect to behave well behaves very poorly. And the person we expect to behave poorly behaves very well. How so? Abraham, the prophet of God, lies about Sarah. While Abimelech, the pagan ruler, acts with integrity towards Sarah. Let's see this for ourselves in the text of Scripture. Abraham's lie occurs for us in verse 2. The way that Abraham lied was this way. Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, she is my sister. Now, scholars, Bible scholars, will point out to us that this is a half-truth, right? It's not like it's a direct lie, like a full lie. It's an omission of the truth, is one way people put it. Sarah and Abraham indeed had the same father, but not the same mother. But I ask you this. If Abraham was here today and he said, hey, Sarah is just my sister, man. If anyone took a serious look at the evidence of their relationship, at the way their relationship fleshed itself out, there is no way that Abraham's claim would stand up in a court of law, right? There's no way that he is merely in a platonic sister-brother relationship with Sarah. They shared the same address. They lived together. They tried to make babies together. One of the first things recorded in Genesis about Abraham was his marriage to Sarah. And God himself explicitly refers to Sarah as Abraham's wife, not his sister. So if you just look at the evidence, there's just no way it adds up, Abraham. She is not just your sister. He really did mean to imply to Abimelech that he was not married to her. He really did mean to imply that. And that is a lie. That is a half-cocked description of Sarah as his sister. And this from a prophet of God of whom we expect so much better, don't we? You're a prophet, but you're lying. What's with that? Why do God's people behave this way sometimes? You contrast this lie from the prophet of God with the integrity of the pagan ruler Abimelech. Verse 2, remember, records that when Abraham said that Sarah is merely his sister, Abimelech sent and took Sarah. This king genuinely thought Sarah was unattached and available for marriage according to the customs of his time. He genuinely thought that, right? He's made inquiry. Abraham says it's just a sister. He's like, cool. Come be my wife. Historians will tell us that this may have been a savvy move by Abimelech, right? He may have heard about these victories that Abraham had won against these invading armies. And he thought, hey, this guy has got such a large enterprise under his control. He's got a big empire, a business, and all that sort of jazz going on. To marry into that family would be advantageous for me. It would secure an alliance with Abraham, who is a brilliant, brilliant man who has won victories in war. Whatever the case may be, whether this was politically motivated, whether it was true love, I guess we'll never know. But Abimelech wanted her as his wife. And from the information that Abimelech had about Sarah, there was no sin there. There was no transgression by calling her to be his wife and courting her. It's not like he bedded her on the first night, right? It says that he hadn't even approached her at this time when God confronted him, meaning they hadn't slept together yet. He's just making plans for her to be his wife. That's an amazing bit of integrity in itself, don't you think, from a pagan king? In any case, this guy, he's thinking he's doing an honorable thing. He's working off with the assumption that he's being... that he's got integrity. And so when God confronts Abimelech about Sarah, he is quite rightly bewildered that the God of the universe, that Abraham's God, would come to him and tell him that he's doing something wrong. And so he says to God, Lord, will you kill an innocent people? Did Abraham not himself say to me, she is my sister? And she herself said, he is my brother. In the integrity of my heart, in the innocence of my hands, I have done this. You feel for the guy, don't you? Oh, and he's not heading out to do some deliberate sinful thing. He's trying to do the right thing here, and the Lord says to him, you're a dead man. You take another step towards Sarah, you're a dead man. I feel for this guy. I feel for Abimelech, man. He thinks he's doing the right thing. He's got a point. And it's an integrity, right, that God himself confirms. God recognizes that Abimelech, this pagan king, has acted with integrity. He says to Abimelech, he says, I know that you have done this in the integrity of your heart. I know that, Abimelech. So here we are. Abraham, the prophet of God, lies about being married to Sarah. and he behaves far worse than what we expect of him. And Abimelech, the pagan king, acted with integrity, behaving far better than what we expect. That being the case, notice now the way that these two men, Abraham and Abimelech, respond when they are confronted about their actions. Notice their response to confrontation. Once again, we will see that even in confrontation, the one we expect to behave well behaves very poorly, and the one we expect to behave very poorly behaves very well. Abraham's confrontation comes from Abimelech, right? The guy wants answers. You said you weren't married, and here God tells me that you are. He's rightly, I think, a little bit ticked off at this point, and he wants to know what's going on. Why would you do such a thing, to lie about your wife? So Abraham, when he's confronted by Abimelech, he starts appealing to technicalities, right? You see this in the passage. We already hinted at this. In verse 12, he says, "She is indeed my sister. She really is my sister. She is the daughter of my father, though not the daughter of my mother." So there's technically, yeah. Yes, she is my sister. I didn't lie, Abimelech. You know, technically that's still true. She was indeed his half-sister, to be more accurate. But regardless from this fact, Abraham is at this point far from owning up to the mess that he has caused, right? He doesn't own up to the deception. He doesn't say, "Yep, you're right, Abimelech, I lied. What now?" He doesn't. He still appeals that she is his sister. And then, notice this, Abraham flings God under the bus. He says, "This is God's fault that I talk about Sarah this way." He says, in effect, "I started lying about Sarah being my sister when God caused me to wander from my father's house. The reason I do this is because God did something to me." You see, Abraham is still a long way from taking responsibility for the situation. And this from a prophet of God, of whom we expect far better. Now contrast Abraham's response with that of Abimelech. Notice the contrast. After a rather unpleasant confrontation from God at night in a dream, which reminds Abimelech of all the true consequences of sin, the ultimate consequence of sin, which is death, what we don't see from Abimelech is a response of excuse making and avoidance of the issue at hand. After all, Abimelech is a king. He's an autocratic king. He can choose who he marries, whenever, wherever. So you might expect, right, if he wants to be the defensive guy and blame shift, like Abraham did, he may have said, "Well, Abraham should have been more honest. So I'm going to go ahead and marry Sarah. He should have been more honest. His loss." Or he could have said something like, "I'm the king around here. I marry who I please." All those things are technically true, right? They are technically true. But instead, this pagan ruler does something quite unexpected. Take a look at verse 8 with me. Abimelech rose early in the morning and called his servants and told them all these things. And then the passage goes on to say, after he has personally enriched Abraham monetarily, given him great wealth and possessions, he returned Sarah, his wife, to him. This is a pagan king. I want you to take a good look at that phrase, early in the morning. Abimelech rose early in the morning. Of all the things that you leave in the Bible, right? Why leave us with that detail? Early in the morning. The most reasonable reason that this precise detail is in the text is to show us how remarkably responsive and obedient Abimelech was to God. It wasn't later in the day, it wasn't the next day, it was early in the morning. It is a phrase akin to what we might say, at the first opportunity. At the very first opportunity to be obedient, Abimelech was obedient. And this from a pagan ruler of whom we expect far worse. So here we are. Abraham, the prophet of God, lied and evaded responsibility, behaving far worse than what we expect of him. And Abimelech, the pagan ruler, acted with integrity and quick obedience to God, behaving far better than what we expect of him. What do we learn from these contrasting characters? Firstly, it is true that sometimes unbelievers like Abimelech do at times demonstrate a far greater moral integrity than professing believers. That is a sad commentary on the people of God. Everyday life will tell you this. This is no secret. You live, you observe people, you talk to people, you will find that on occasions, unbelievers have an enviable moral integrity about their lives, to the shame of professing believers. I've seen it. I've experienced it time and time again. And we have to ask ourselves as a Christian community, how can this be? How do we account for the fact that people who do not honor God, who do not regard him, who make no reference to him when they go about life, often have this profound moral integrity about them? The passage reveals part of the answer for us. In verse 6, the Lord said to Abimelech, "It was I who kept you from sinning against me. It was I who kept you from sinning against me." In Christianity, in the Christian faith, we have a doctrine, and the doctrine goes by the name of common grace. And all the doctrine communicates to us is that for all that the Bible teaches us about the human heart and its disinclination towards God, that God himself makes loving provision even towards the most wayward of hearts, by restraining the degree of sin which we are capable of. This is why Abimelech, a man who did not worship the Lord, behaved with such moral integrity, because it's the Lord's loving disposition to prevent him from being as bad as his heart would incline him to be. It is a testimony, an affirmation of the goodness of God in maintaining moral virtue even outside the community of faith. It's one of the reasons why, for most of us, I hope for all of us, why we won't go home to robbed houses and smashed windows, right? There is this pervading goodness of God to maintain even an unbelieving world with some sense of moral integrity. So that's the first thing we learn from these characters: common grace. Secondly, the Bible makes no secret of the fact that believers sometimes behave very poorly. That's no secret, right? The Bible is not this book. It's just glistening with examples of God's people being these morally virtuous people. Quite often, they're just not. And the Bible doesn't pretend that didn't happen or scrub over that or cut that out and just set that aside. It's not that kind of book. It's a warts and all kind of book. Sometimes believers behave very poorly, and this is not an excuse for our poor behavior. It's just a fact we have to wrestle with as Christian people. And neither does this mean we make peace with these defects in our behavior. We actually do want to be transformed people of integrity. But it is a battle. It will take work. And this brings me to my third point. For the battle, we are given the gift of obedience. Bear with me. I know that word gets a bad rap. Christians start talking about obedience and everybody's all on a high horse about don't tell everyone else what to do, all that kind of thing. It's not like that. I know it usually gets a negative connotation, but not so in Christianity. In Christianity, it's obedience which liberates us. It's interesting too in this passage, because this freedom and obedience, the obedience that we want, is not demonstrated by Abraham, but by Abimelech, who so early in the morning made every effort to put right what he has wronged. Don't overlook this. If you are aware of your inconsistencies in obedience towards God or moral integrity, it is the pursuit of obedience, which is God's kind gift, which will liberate you from those things. The Bible promises this as a step towards liberty from sin, including the unintentional sins that harm others. Lastly, I have a fourth point for you this morning. Very un-Presbyterian. Fourth point. We learn that in spite of Abraham's lying and inability to accept responsibility, God's purposes for him is not tethered to his moral performance. Let me just say that one more time, because this is crucial if you are to understand the gospel. That God's purposes for Abraham is not tethered, attached to, conditioned upon his moral performance. This is huge. The gospel, the purposes of God to save for himself a people from the curse of sin for a glorious eternity does not rest upon their transcript of moral record, right? It's not like passing high school or passing a university exam, where it does depend on how you perform, on what you do. That is not how the gospel works. It is not on you. It's not on your record to save yourself. It is on the record of someone else. Right? When God goes looking for a moral record to scrutinize, to see whether you will be saved, He doesn't look at your record. He looks at Christ's. He looks at the perfect record of His Son. And He says, that record is squeaky clean, and it is yours by faith. And therefore, His purposes for us as the believing community is not tethered to our moral inconsistencies, nor our moral consistencies. It is tethered to the record of Christ on our behalf. That is how the gospel works. That is our hope.